I'd just like to briefly draw your attention to the rules of the House. So as we just said, we'll be going from proposition, starting with George, then the opposition with Gareth, and then we'll have a 20 to 30 minute section for members of the audience to give floor speeches if you like. If you mind keeping those brief, about 2 to 3 minutes in length, we'll be timing you and give you a little buzz if you go over. If you raise your hand before, I will pick you to speak and then just come up and either speak or we'll go proposition and alternate opposition. Well then, as we said, have Philip followed by Emily, and then another section for floor speeches for around 10 to 20 minutes long, and then we'll have brief concluding remarks from each side. So keeping that brief, and with no further ado, I look to George Romeo to open the case for the proposition.
Well, thank you. I realise that what I'm going to say tonight is about as welcome as a Jehovah's Witness at the door during the World Cup final. probably I'm about as welcome. But it's actually a real joy to be doing this with Gareth and Emily, who are two people who are going to keep it friendly and respectful, and it's going to be a sweet debate, whatever we believe at the end of it. So thanks, guys, and it's a delight to be doing it with you. And Philip and I don't believe we're going to win the vote. If we did, I expect someone would come and cast us off. But try as much as you can to just put the immediate interests to one side and try to judge the arguments by their merits, even if you do walk out of the wrong door at the end. And the reason I'm here is that last year I had a realisation, not a very nice realisation, which is that climate breakdown, which is what I call it because climate change sounds a bit like calling foreign invasion unexpected visitors, but climate breakdown is only the third most urgent of the environmental crises we face. And that's not because it's become any less urgent, certainly not, but it's because there are two other issues which seem, to my mind now, to be even more pressing, to be happening even faster than climate breakdown. And that's the ecological cleansing of both land and sea by the way we produce our food. And the figures are just off the scale. It's quite extraordinary what's happening. Since 1970, the vertebrate life forms, the wild animals with backbones, their populations have declined by 60%. Worldwide. Species which seemed to be perfectly safe a few years ago, like lions or house sparrows, are now in imminent danger. Insect populations are crashing at such a rate where we don't even know what the implications are likely to be for either human beings or for the rest of the living system. Worldwide, the soil is being stripped from the land so rapidly. And according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, we have 60 years of harvests left. We're facing the wall, ladies and gentlemen. 60 years of harvests left. Groundwater is being depleted so fast that some of the world's most important aquifers will be emptied within a generation. There's no point in denying this. This is an existential crisis that we face, and it's being driven, above all else, by the way we eat. And we have a responsibility to ourselves and to those who are yet to come to sort this out as quickly and as effectively as we possibly can. Now, there's no single solution, it's a multiple crisis. But the quickest and most effective and the biggest of the possible solutions is a switch from an animal-based diet to a plant-based diet. Now, I speak as someone phenomenally greedy. I may have eaten everything that can possibly be eaten, from earwigs to Greenland sharks to woodlice. I mean, I'll try them all. I'll stick it in my mouth and say, pass it, so they're disgusting. But I've very reluctantly made the switch to an almost completely plant-based diet, except for a bit of roadkill and all the fish I catch and a very weird vegan. But this is simply because I've seen the writing on the wall and I've seen the shift which we're going to have to make if we're going to get through this century. Now, this is really dangerous times that we're living in. And the reason that an animal-based diet is driving so much of this destruction and danger is because it requires so much more land and resources than a plant-based diet does. When we feed animals on crops, we greatly reduce the amount of people that any one cropping area can support. And this is because in the conversion from plant protein to animal protein, we lose about two-thirds on average of the plant value. And so we can support two-thirds fewer people on the land that those crops are producing. The UK has a farmland footprint over twice as great as our arable land area. And that's principally because we eat, on average, our body weight of meat every year. And we can't supply that within our own borders. So we rely on the rest of the world to feed us. And it seems to me that at a time when we're threatened with both ecological collapse and the possibility of mass starvation, because it's really hard to see where the food for 10 billion people is going to come from, feeding to animals the food that we can eat ourselves is an unsupportable luxury. Of course, there's another way of creating meat, which is allowing animals to feed themselves on fields and rangelands. And in this case, you're not competing with food for humans, but you are competing in a massive way with habitats for wildlife and ecosystems. And the reason for this is that you need an awful lot of grazing land to produce a quantity of meat. I'll give you a couple of examples. Grazing occupies roughly twice as much land around the world as cropping does. Twice as much as all the arable land is given over to grazing. And yet it produces, pasture produces, 1 gram of the 81 grams of protein that we eat on average every day. 1 gram out of 81 grams. This is a phenomenally inefficient way of using land. And it ensures that land which could otherwise be supporting the wildlife and the ecosystems which are in such desperate trouble everywhere around the world is instead being used to produce meat for us. In this country, roughly 4 million hectares of land is used to husband sheep, mostly in the uplands. And that's almost as much land as all the arable and horticultural land put together in Britain. And yet it supplies just 1.2% of our food. Now, Gareth, who is a truly delightful man and entirely sincere in his beliefs and beautiful in the way he expresses them, will tell you about his wonderful land and the birds and the flowers he sees and the Carnegie ponies and the rest of it. And I see the beauty of it. I really do. I see the beauty of what it does and what the other keepers, husbanders of livestock do. It is a lovely system, and it's deeply implanted in our culture. But when I look at the uplands of Britain, I see the hollowed out shells of ecosystems, devastated places. A thriving living system is one with large predators, with large herds of wild herbivores, with a rich mosaic of vegetation types, with trees. We don't see many of those in the uplands. I mean, where Gareth farms would almost certainly be Atlantic rainforest, temperate rainforest, punctuated with a mosaic of other habitats, supporting many times the diversity and abundance of wildlife that we see in the uplands today. A study in the Cairngorms shows that of nationally important species, woodland there supports 11 times more than the grassland. And keeping sheep, well, is a highly effective way of reducing an ecosystem to almost nothing. Worldwide, marshes are being drained, forests are being felled, the tree seedlings are being grazed out, predators are being wiped out, herbivores are being excluded in order to create more space for livestock. Magnificent ecosystems. It's heartbreaking to see it, like the rainforests in Madagascar and Brazil are being destroyed just so we can have even more farmed animals living in those places. A single species, a cow or a sheep, just replacing a vast panoply, great diversity of wild animals. And it seems to me that in an age of ecological crisis, this is an astonishing extravagance, and I do not believe it is justified. Simon Fairley, a wonderful man who, among his many other roles, is a small livestock keeper, has estimated that were we to switch to a plant-based diet in the UK, we could feed everyone in this country on 3 million of our 18 million hectares of farmland. Alternatively, we could use all our cropping land to feed 200 million people on a plant-based diet here. And it seems to me that when we're threatened with the trends that I've described, to do otherwise is simply perverse. It doesn't seem to make sense. Well, what I've described so far is why I believe we should switch from a meat-based diet. We should stop eating meat. But of course, the question in the debate is, will we? And here, too, I believe the answer is yes. And there's a simple reason for that, and it is technological change. Now, at the moment, the change I'm talking about is as obscure and marginal as the motor car was in 1880, or the personal computer was in 1970. But cultivated meat, cultured meat, lab-grown meat, obscure and marginal as it is today, will inexorably do what those technologies did. At the moment, it's phenomenally expensive. In a decade or two, it will be merely expensive. In perhaps four decades, it is likely to be at cost parity with processed meat. And then the price will keep going down and down. It will do what the motor car did to the horse and carriage. It will do what the telephone did to the telegram. It will do what the computer did to the typewriter. And in doing so, it will become entirely ordinary. It will just be part of our lives. And what we will see at the same time, which is what we've seen several times in history before, is that the technological shift will be accompanied by an ethical shift. When hydrocarbons provided a substitute for whale oil, we suddenly wondered why we were killing those magnificent creatures. When automation undercut child labour, we started to ask ourselves why children were working in factories. And the same will happen in this case. When a kinder and cheaper alternative arises, what seemed permissible before suddenly becomes unacceptable. Research at this university shows that artificial meat, cultured meat, by comparison to the ordinary meat we eat today, reduces water use by 80% and reduces land use by 99%. It will massively reduce the pressure on the living world and on food supplies. It will allow another 3 billion people to be fed. It changes everything. So, my friends, will meat eating stop by 2100? I submit two things. Firstly, that it should. Secondly, that it will. Thank you.
I thank the honourable guest for his speech, and I now look to Gareth and James to open the case for the opposition.
The old cook, Alan, George. Thank you from the bottom of my heart.
The old cook, Alan.
Well, what a speech. And to be honest, you know, for me, as a hill farmer that loves what he does every single day, I've got to totally disagree with you on a lot of things. And I was waiting for George to be standing here as the grim reaper where the end is nigh. And it was nearly there, George, but do you know what, guys? I think that we live in a fantastic time and we should be showboating what we're doing as an industry. As a farmer that lives on the hills in North Wales and has been farming that land for 350 years, well, my family has, not me, actually. Alright, looked really good. I believe that farming and nature can live as one. And I am really, really annoyed when I hear the sheep wrecking stories and the devastation and the destruction to wildlife and nature, and it does happen in some places, but the majority of farmers that I know and landowners, they want to leave that land in a better state for the next generation. And guys, sometimes that's been hard because government, supermarkets, and whatever's been thrown at us has been very, very difficult. I'm going to need some water. But the truth is that we have gone over every step they've thrown. We've worked hard, we've been honest, and we've done our job. But I think George is right. There is time for change, and I think we need more sustainable ways of producing food. and we need ways where we can bring the people that live in our cities and our towns back into our lives. We need to reconnect. 80% of these people haven't got a clue where their food comes from, and to be truthful about it, they don't care. The supermarkets have pushed and pushed and pushed, and a lot of the government policies have pushed and made farmers cut corners, and it shouldn't happen. We should be producing, and we are producing, of the highest qualities, but then when we get these four burgers for a pound, there's something wrong, guys. Cheap food does come at a cost, and it comes at a cost to a lot of things. So as a farmer from North Wales, I'd like to tell you a little bit about what we do. We keep about 4,000 ewes running on a heff. A heff, a knebbing to us, is where we put the sheep. It's where the sheep belong. There's 22 farmers on our area of the Carnelli. 22 farmers agreed to take them sheep off for 6 months of the winter. So the mountain gets the chance to rejuvenate, to grow, and on the 1st of April, them sheep are put back. And our families have been doing this for hundreds of years. And this is why we've got the chuff. This is why we've got the twite. This is why we've got the montane meats and the blanket bogs. Because we've farmed that land properly. And a lot of farmers do exactly the same. And that's the way to move forward in life. Last year, I was asked to bring a vegan onto my farm. By God, that was a difficult decision to do. Okay? Because some of the stuff I've had has been absolutely atrocious. And George has had the same. We've spoken about it earlier. I think we've got to have a respect for each other. Whatever your opinion is, and I think, you know, George's opinion is his, we'll never agree, but I will respect it. And that's so important. But bringing this vegan onto my farm was the twitchiest thing I've ever done. His name was Tim Chief, and when the BBC phoned me, they said they had a ninja warrior. A ninja warrior, a vegan free runner coming onto the farm. Well, I was expecting some guy with some sword walking up into the yard. But it was a little guy. Tim was really nice. I shook his hand and I said, "You respect me today and I'll respect you." And that's how we started. We went to my field where I grow the vegetables to feed my children, and I grow a lot of my stuff myself, and we sat down and we planted some salads. We do eat greens. And off we went, planting away. And I asked him, "Tim, how much of your own food do you plant?" He'd never planted a seed. He'd never planted anything. And I asked him, "You understand a little bit about what we do here? Our soil is quite poor, so we always have to put something back. We use fertilizer, etc." So over in the corner is a big pile of old wire. "Mammy had manure to you, Judge." And I said, "Every time we grow something, we put something back. And that's how we work from here, because you've got to, that's the circle." And we were walking and talking and planting. And he said to me, "So does this feed your family?" So it's about a quarter of an acre. "It won't feed my family for a year, but it'll feed a big piece of my family for bits and bobs," I said to him. And I said, "I did have a problem a couple of weeks ago. We had a rabbit coming in, and I had to shoot that rabbit, because if I didn't shoot that rabbit, he would be eating my family's food." Well, he was devastated. "Can you fence it? Can you put bricks in? Can you stop the rabbit coming in?" "No, there's other rabbits running around, but it's keeping that balance. It was making sure I could keep that food for my family. But by taking that rabbit out," I said, "that was feeding my family as well." Seriously made the situation even worse. The free runner was doing cartwheels. But we had a good day. He would never, ever come into my thinking. But, you know, he respected what I did. But what I got out of it, and what I understood, the end of that day. We had finished building, and we were standing up on the top of the Gardneddau, looking over onto the Lenai Straits, onto Anglesey, and the sun was setting. It was very romantic, really, like it was just two guys up there. And Colin Gibson said to me, "Is that it, Gap?" And I said, "I've got one more question." And he said, "Do you want to film it? It's up to you, but I think it might be worth filming." And I thought about this all day. And I said, "Tim, if you were born my son, do you think you would be standing here now as a vegan?" And his words were, his words were, "No, I don't think I would." And he said, "Peace, man, and give me a big hug." And it was peace, and it brought a tear to my eye. And do you know what? That's where we're going wrong. Education is key. I think we need to take farming back in the curriculum. I think we need to get governments involved. We need to get people, kids, back on our farms. It's so important. Let them make the choice themselves if they want to eat meat. Let them see the farms. Let them see the milking. Let them see the piggeries. Let them see whatever. And then they can make their choices for themselves. We are on the crossroads, I think, with Brexit, for the biggest farming food revolution in this country. And we have got to make this work. And I think if we want a future, if I want to see my grandchildren on their mountains producing lamb and wool and beef, I think we'll have to change. We'll have to eat less meat, but I think it'll have to be more sustainable. More sustainable for us all. Looking at the bigger picture, it is frightening. And looking at importing food as we are, it shouldn't happen. Let's build a better Britain on our bellies, starting here. I'll have to have another drink. I'm drying up, guys. And respect is something that we spoke about today. Social media is a platform for us as farmers. I know you see me on Twitter and stuff, and there has been some serious comments and some nasty stuff going on. This has got to stop, guys. This us and them, it's got to stop now. You know, banter and fun is great, but things are just getting that little bit far. And I respect the right for somebody not to eat meat, but I really believe they should respect our right to produce it and eat it, because that is something that I believe in. I want to hunt, shoot and fish. I want to feed my family with food that's produced on the farm, and I'll be out of a job if people don't eat meat. I'll be out of a job because I can't get combines up onto 3,000 feet on the mountain. So for me, I need to change, I need to adapt, but I need to connect with the consumer, the customer, because the consumer and the customer is king, and that is the way forward. Diolch o galon, thank you very much from the bottom of my heart. Before I finish, I've got something to talk to. As a peace offering, my daughter, who's 13, I shear the sheep, but she's got her own little business. And she makes Welsh woolen hats. And hopefully George will accept this.
Thank you, Denison, for his speech. The floor will now be open to contributions from the floor. And I look for a first speaker in the proposition of the motion.
You may wonder why I'm on this side. Did I eat my last steak last night? But we have to applaud George Monbiot, our knight in shining armour this evening. We've talked all day about embracing change, and George is kindly preparing us for this in spades. He must have been talking to Dieter Held. No animals, no slurry, no pollution to pay for. Problem solved. The hills and dales will revert to lovely bracken and birch. The perfect environment for ticks. And I will be starting the Tick Preservation Society. I will invite George to be its first president. Now, if you've ever been to China, you will have seen the hundreds of tower blocks built on the edge of cities. They've moved all the old people from the countryside to become city dwellers. We could do the same with all our hill farmers. No longer will they be stigmatised about being called park keepers. No more lambing in a snowstorm. No tourists leaving gates open. No dry stone walls to maintain. Just sit in your 89th floor flat in Cardiff, reading Saga magazine and Tick Weekly. And ordering your protein pills online, because by 2100 we will surely have broadband. The tourists will still come, and Duncan can organise wildlife spotting expeditions for lynx, wolf and beaver, finishing up with a 3D printed burger in the last pub in the valley. The proposer of the motion is the highly articulate architect of change. You have to support this motion, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you for the speech for the first opposition operation.
Thank you, Mr. President. My lords, ladies and gentlemen, there's a fundamental flaw in the motion, I'm afraid, and that flaw is that it's based entirely on a growing unease we have as a society in killing animals. Well, I believe that slaughter is a good thing, and society will learn to embrace it. Let me explain. This unease with killing animals, it's based on our own fear of our own mortality. We're afraid to die. So we can't bear the fact that we determine the death of another mortal being. Why do we project this, our own fragile insecurity on the animals in our care? Let's turn it on its head and look at the ridiculous way in which we die. Okay? Now, as someone who spent 2 years watching his father die of Alzheimer's, and whose forearms went the same way, I know that my brain is going to give out before my body. And I'm terrified of what life is going to be like when that happens. Far better if we choose a date that I am put to death. My slaughter day, if you like. Or death day. I have a birthday. Why not a death day? So, think of the advantages. I won't end my days dribbling with indignity into my soup in some old people's home that cost my family a small fortune. If you roll it out across everyone, think of the savings for the taxpayer, the opportunities to cull an overpopulated planet. Of course, I'll need to sort out the legal side, and I need a good lawyer for that, and then there's a farm to think about. Who might turn to as a good agent? Of course! Honestly, so you can see, slaughter is something to be embraced, but as soon as we realise that a good life ends with a good death, then you realise what an absurd notion it is that we should ever stop eating meat. So, I implore you, go through the door. Thank you.
And now look for another speaker in proposition.
Ladies and gentlemen, I didn't prepare this, so I'll keep it brief. I was tricked by a vegan, an unusual thing given what I'm about to say. She made me put a ring on it, as they say, before I married her, and that's how she tricked me. But she changed to become vegan, and she did this for health reasons. And that's not health reasons of the cows. Or the chickens. This was for her benefit. I am, I suppose, fortunate enough to call myself now a flexitarian. For anyone that doesn't know what a flexitarian is, That means I'm greedy. I have everything. I eat all of the vegan food, and I also eat all of the meat. However, it has enlightened me to my health. I don't look like I'm starving. I'm eating well. I must say the vegan chicken nuggets are actually really quite nice. I do try them. This is the thing. 80 years from now, that is a long time. We talk about making the right decisions when it comes to pesticides, and we say it should be based on science, not on opinions. And so that's the only thing. I love you to say it's been, what, 24 hours since I had my mask. But I just, for this side of the argument, there is definitely health benefits. And 80 years from now, who knows what that's going to look like. Thank you.
Mr. President, Madam Chair, members of the House, I am utterly disappointed. I was watching videos on YouTube the other night before my flight down here from Edinburgh to Heathrow, trying to kill time, trying to get sleep. So I went on YouTube and I started watching videos by vegan activists stopping lorries going into slaughterhouses. And I was really hoping that George was going to be your stereotypical vegan and come up here and say that all farmers are monsters and we need to stop rearing animals right now to save the world. And I'm annoyed, ladies and gentlemen, because I found myself agreeing with quite a lot of what George was saying. I did have something prepared because I want to come out and chat about the ethics behind it, you know, what is ethical, what isn't. Tom covered quite a lot of that. I found myself agreeing with most of what George was saying. I'll get my views back again because I have to write some stuff down. I'd just like to pick up on some points that George made. You made the point that more people are fed from a hectare of plants than animals, and you used some stuff about the Cairngorms. I stay about 40 minutes from the Cairngorms, and it is incredibly mountainous. I don't think that as an arable farmer I'll be dropping my plough anytime soon up there to produce crops from it. There is a place in the UK for farmed animals. There always has been, and I think there always will be. And so in that point alone, you know, the motion is going to stand. And there is a point to counteract that as well, is that sheep have a place in the environment because they can control population of harmful insects that could be to the detriment of other animals. So in direct contrast to your point, I think that sheep actually help the environment in a place like the Cairngorms by control of population, and it's no use for much else apart from livestock farming in a sustainable way, obviously. And then to come on to the point where you talked about at the end about factory-produced meat being really good, uses less water, less land, and I totally agree with you that. I think that our world is broken, ladies and gentlemen. If we keep on going at the rate that we're going of deforestation and whatever else, using massive amounts of water, I think the next war will be about water. Then we're going to wreck the planet. And you could well be right. We might only have 60 harvests left if we keep on going on this trajectory. But I think that there will always be a place for meat production in this in the world in a sustainable way. And I think that the UK is very good at producing meat sustainably. It's grass-fed. We use the land appropriate. We grow crops and nice bits and livestock in LFA areas. And I will beg you to oppose the motion, ladies and gentlemen. I was born in 1995. I will be 105 in 2100. If I last that long, I don't think I will due to the unhealthy lifestyle choices I make. But the New Year's Day in 2100, I will be eating a fillet steak. Great. Thank you very much.
The speech, and now for a first speaker in Potsdam.
Thank you. I didn't expect to speak this evening, but I'm doing so because I feel sorry for George. George and I have crossed swords a few times, but I feel sorry for him because no one will speak on his behalf. But I'm going to, George, okay? And last time I saw George, he spoke for 55 minutes in front of a fireplace in Sussex on sheep wrecked then, which of course I fundamentally agree. But this evening, I want to speak on his behalf. And there's one point that hasn't been made, which I think is an important point. Okay, and I'm going to speak on what might happen. What's the time frame? 2100, is it? Well, that's a long time in the future. And we've heard today about change and how change accelerates. Well, it is accelerating. And I'm not a sheep farmer, I'm a cattle farmer, but I'm also an arable farmer. And I'm a young one, I'm old enough, I'm now, I'm afraid, to remember what bloody hard work it was looking after sheep, up a sheep's backside every 5 minutes, foot rocking them. That's what's given me my bad way. But I'm also aware to what an easy life arable farming is. And I think today's young farmers are a bit brighter than I am. Do you want to end up, like me, an old fart with a bad back because he's been foot-rotting sheep and up a sheep backside in his young life? Or do you want to sit in an air-conditioned, dust-free car when it's all controlled by computers and you get out at the end of the day and then spend a bloody good evening in the pub rather than being knackered? It's bloody obvious what's going to happen by 21. It really is. And I'm really surprised you, George, as someone that's probably as intelligent as anyone, hasn't actually made that point, so I'll make him forward. So, as someone who came this evening knowing which door I was going to walk out of, I'm going to walk out of a different door. Because I think, if we really are serious, we heard about this incredible computer thing. I mean, there's only one way you can look after livestock, and that is by giving them individual attention. If they are left to their own devices, by Christ, think what the animal rights people are going to be like in 2100. They're bad enough now. We get fined for having the wrong ear tags, for Christ's sake. What's it going to be like in 2100? So, ladies and gentlemen, farmers, sheep farmers, I'm afraid I'm going to walk out of a different door. And if you think about it, you might walk out of a different one as well.
My lords, ladies and gentlemen, today Oxford Farming Conference has highlighted that times are changing. And they're changing fast. But surely ruminants are the most efficient converters of human digestible iron and protein from grass. Grass stores carbon, it reduces erosion too. Meanwhile, my livestock produce the best plant fertiliser in the form of cow poo.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your speech, and look for a first speaker in proposition of the
motion. As a Lincolnshire farmer, I thought it was only fair to speak in favour of vegetable farmers. There are people who produce something other than that. But unfortunately, with the supermarkets selling vegetables at 19p this Christmas, none of them can afford to come to this conference.
Thank you very much. This gathering reminds
me... Of course,
it's now time to talk about the F word. Not the one you think. No, this is the elephant in the room of all vegetarians. Flatulence. They don't like to talk about it. And of course it's going to create three problems for us. And the first of those is air pollution. So come 2100, the air conditioning in this room is not going to be good enough for this gallery. It won't be. And then we've got noise pollution. At the beginning of every NFU council meeting, they stand for a minute in silence for departed comrades. Will they be able to manage that under the vegetarian regime? Some serious butter clenching going on. But the real problem is methane. The sudden eruption of methane that was never there before. This ghastly greenhouse gas. All the work that we've done to stop the greenhouse gases killing us will all come back again through this. And George may well argue, yes, but of course, you're going to lose ruminants and therefore balance. I disagree, because most of the meat we eat comes from pigs and poultry. They're not ruminants. This debate isn't about banning milk drinking. They come from, that comes from ruminants. And we will still need the sheep from the hills to feed all these leopards and lions and wolves and There's another problem too, because how are you going to get your protein? Well, you're going to get it from eating lentils and legumes. And what do? Produce nitrous oxide, another ghastly greenhouse gas to kill this planet. So, ladies and gentlemen, for the sake of a fragrant life, for the sake of a peaceful life, for the sake of any life at all, please oppose.
It's not a joke. When you're protecting your farms in 2100, when you've got big fences around them, when there's a procession of people from the starving south walking around your farms, I hope that you consider your steaks and burgers to be worth it. This is not a joke. The science is overwhelming. You claim to be in favour of education. Educate yourselves. You are contributing through your belligerence to a situation which is unspeakable. Is it worth it? Does that steak really taste that good?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think I've ever been called far right by Stuart Aitken.
No, I
have. This gathering reminds me of a farmer's wedding I went to, and the best man, another farmer, stood up and asked all the guests at the wedding feast, have we got any vegetarians here? And a few very sheepish or some other sort of vegetarian term, hands went up, and the best man said, many thanks for that. That has nothing to do with any catering reasons. That's just so all the farmers know who you are. Now, I used to edit a meat magazine. I now edit a potato magazine. So if there's anyone out there who's got a vegetable magazine, I think my plate would be better if I was employed on that. But my point to George is, it's a dystopian nightmare, the idea of cultural meat being produced by one corporation in the hands of the food being produced in just that one corporate hands, putting farmers across the world out of a business and being able to steward and look after that land. Is that really the dystopian nightmare that we might be facing in 2100 that George has proposed? So I suggest we oppose this motion. Thank you.
Thank you for the speech, and now over to Philip Limmery to continue the case for the proposition.
Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you to the Oxford Farming Conference for the invitation to be here, the opportunity to be part of this theatre. And it does seem to me that the Oxford Farming Conference have been benevolent to us all in extending that festive party mood, the panto season, and bringing forward two panto villains in George Shipwrecked Mombia and Farmageddon Phil. So thank you so much for having us here. And continuing the theme that George began, we realise that we are as welcome in this gathering as Donald Trump at a gathering of the Democrat Party, or indeed at any party. We thank you sincerely for having us along all the same. Now, in my day job at Compassion and World Farming, you'll hear me passionately advocating for an urgent move away from factory farming towards a more humane, compassionate way, less and better meat from pasture-fed, free-range or organic. Tonight, we're being asked to look much farther forward, beyond a reasonable lifetime's expectation. Certainly for one in their mid-50s. And so to look forward, I'd like to take us back. Because you see, humanity has been farming animals since the dawn of agriculture, 10,000 years ago. Somewhere along the fertile banks of the river Euphrates and Tigris, first goats and then sheep were corralled, bred and slaughtered for meat. And so it was in Mesopotamia, now Iraq, way back in the Stone Age, where this rich supply of protein enabled and nourished the very cradle of civilization. It enabled hunter-gatherers to settle in communities, creating craftsmen, priests, soldiers and scribes, who in turn went on to invent the wheel, the chariot and the ox-drawn plough. And so it was. So it was that the business of corralling, breeding and slaughtering animals for meat was born into a big wide world with very few people and near untapped resources. In Mesopotamia's Neolithic times, Homo sapiens numbered but 1 million souls. Now there are 7 billion of us, soon to be 10. Agriculture has expanded to occupy half the usable land surface of the planet. Things have changed since the Stone Age, beyond all recognition. Yet one thing has barely changed at all. The way we corral, breed, and slaughter animals for meat. Where it has changed is not being for the better. Take factory farming, where animals are caged, crated and confined. Pigs kept in crates so narrow they can't turn around, made to face the wall for much of their lives. Cattle crowded into feedlots, fed grain instead of grass. And chickens crowded so tightly they'll have more room in the oven. Mr. President, that is the reality of how the majority of farm animals are reared in this country, in Europe, and in the world today. It's a cruel and wasteful process, one that is shrouded in mythology. That mythology includes the idea that somehow it's an efficient way to produce protein. But get this, factory farmed animals don't produce meat for free. They eat vast quantities of grain, and in so doing they waste most of the food value in terms of calories and protein in conversion to meat and milk. In this way, we waste enough food to feed an extra 4 billion people on the planet. Another myth is that you can only get the right protein from livestock products, particularly meat, but also milk. Well, newsflash. Humanity's protein needs today are supplied, in the majority, by plants. Despite the hype to the contrary, meat produces 18% of our protein needs. Dairy, but a tenth. Yet to produce what amounts to little more than a quarter of our entire protein needs as a global nation, we use 80% of our farmland in rearing livestock. There is little room for growth. In simple land use terms alone, we can't expand livestock production, not really, unless we take down remaining forests, the lungs of the earth. Also, it's not just about land. Climate scientists warn that if by the middle of the century we carry on eating meat like we are, then our food alone could trigger catastrophic livestock change, catastrophic climate change. All in all, Mr. President, I put it to this House that meat has reached its sell-by date. But thankfully, things are beginning to change. Companies are starting to see the writing on the wall. They're starting to see that actually protein can mean more than meat from an animal. In America, that denizen of supersized meat, portions of protein, Americans are regularly giving up meat. A third of Americans. And that proportion is growing rapidly. Such eye-catching growth is attracting the attention of food companies, not wanting to miss out on protein's new dawn. Take Tyson, the world's second largest meat manufacturer, that's invested $150 million in alternative proteins. Not least, the plant-based Beyond Meat burger, tasted in London recently for the very first time by my friend and fellow traveller, Joanna Lumley. Take Cargill, another of the world's biggest meat companies, that recently changed its meat department and called it Protein, in recognition that the future lies elsewhere. Cargill has joined billionaires like Bill Gates and Richard Branson, investing in clean meat from stem cells without the animal, and at a fraction of the climate cost, at a fraction of the land use and water use requirements, while meat from animals, corral bred and slaughtered. Branson believes that in 30 years' time there will be no need to kill animals at all. That all of our meat will either be clean from stem cells or plant-based. It will taste the same as meat does today, but it will be much healthier for everyone. So things are changing. There is a new dawn for protein. It does seem to me that society's love affair with steak from an animal is coming to an end. Be it for reasons of business, animal welfare or sustainability. The likes of tenderloin, sirloin and shank from an animal. The game is up. Like those early wheels made from crude wooden slabs. Like those early chariots. Like the ox-drawn plough. Meat from animals, ground, bred and slaughtered, is going to be a thing of the past. Protein is going to evolve. So I urge this House to embrace the theme of the Oxford Farming Conference this year. Embrace the change and vote for the motion. And vote for the motion. And in so doing, given the climatic and the environmental odds stacking up against humanity seemingly every day, by voting for this motion, you may also just be voting to leave a planet worth having as a legacy for your children. Thank you.
That's my speech, and now I look to Emmy Norton to continue the case for the opposition.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President, and thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you on behalf of the rational sense in the audience. Forgive me, I'm not paid to do this for a living, so I have notes. Sorry. Ladies and gentlemen, as informed and conscientious members of the agricultural community, I do not doubt for a second that you will vote in the correct way this evening. The slippery-tongued rhetoric of the Liberal elite will not con you for a second. Okay? We'll leave it there. They've admitted as much. However, I would like to take this opportunity to challenge your thinking. And I would also like to be as bold as to give you some inspiration as to how we can continue to meet the expectations of society by 2100. Ladies and gentlemen, it is clear that change is coming. Consumer trends change all the time based on fashionable innovation, and farming enables the very success of the human race that has enabled us to engage in this very intellectual debate. It is the privilege of a full belly to be debating the ethics of our dinner plates. But we cannot be resentful of this debate. It has been said Our role as farmers is not the growing of crops, but the cultivation and perfection of human beings. If society demands that we do better, then do better we must. The difficulty in engaging in the vegan debate is in its blind ethical dogma. No science, fact or argument can persuade anyone that a life is a good life or a better life if the consequences of death are the same and it is death that you are seeking to avoid. It is not enough to argue that pasture-fed or grass-fed or sustainably produced livestock is better and it should be preserved because it's environmentally beneficial, because the grazing still results in death. The illogical notion is that in order to avoid the death of farm animals, the vegan society would like the number of farm animals to be reduced to a manageable level, at which point they would be placed in sanctuaries and cared for until they pass away naturally. So no farmed animals at all. Or perhaps only farmed animals in natural conditions. In The Secret Life of Cows by Rosalind Book, I was given 3 copies for Christmas. I've only read it to page 7 because it said, no artificially manufactured conditions could match the reassurance, stability, attention, companionship and appropriate food that nature provides. However, the genetic and archaeological evidence from the domestication process is clear. In example, the cow. These animals have been so successful at domesticating themselves that they no longer have a wild relative. The last aurochs cow died out in the Middle Ages. The modern cow has ensured her genetic immortality by partnering with people in order to get the reassurance, stability, attention, companionship and appropriate food that nature very clearly does not provide. This is the vegan paradox. The logical conclusion is the genetic extinction of farmed animal species. Our frustration as farmers is that we do not achieve anything by pointing this out. Death is still death. I am all too aware of the trend towards veganism in my own business. I'm not ashamed to admit it that it's hurt us financially. Vegan month in November last month, just before Christmas, and we've sent a lot of our produce into London. In running our family dairy business though, I also frequently come across what I call cow-cerned consumers. They are people who've learned a little bit of information or seen or read something on the internet, something online, and they're now worried about the impact that their dietary choices are having on animal welfare. I'm always pleased to inform them that they have a choice. Norton's Dairy specialises in seriously pampered cows. However, I can only vouch for my own business and our own standards of animal welfare. The images and statistics that fill social media feeds come from somewhere. Your farm? Your neighbour's farm? Social media is feeding the new food revolution. It allows individuals to share and acquire information like never before. Individual suspicions about food supply chains are confirmed, and consumers now seek truth and authenticity. There has been a big increase in the demand for free-from foods as a result. Consumers are able to take control of their perceived health benefits. Coincidentally, these products also make it much easier to follow and adopt a vegan diet. One trend enables the other. The obvious irony here, and this I believe is crucial to some of the things that have been said this evening, is the profit-making opportunities associated with the free-from trend. The investment attraction of lab-grown meat is the commercialisation of intellectual property, not consumer sales. The desire for authenticity and suspicion of corporate motivations amongst our consumers all around us mean that such innovations will be of limited relevance. However, for the army of consumers out there who do not care, watch out. Any farm business seeking to produce a kilo of meat at the cheapest cost is vulnerable to this innovation. Inefficient part of the process is converting the energy to a chicken or pig to start with. It makes sense to remove the animal from that process. Major companies are switching business and are exploiting our food chains, waking up the ethical pressure placed on us by these connected consumers. The smartest ones are turning the challenges into opportunities. So, in the face of unanswerable vegan logic and against the inevitable disruption to the quest for cheap meat, what can we do as an industry? Well, first, 88% of vegans live in cities. These are the ones furthest from and therefore least in control of their food sources. We, as an industry, have an obvious need and opportunity to reconnect them with their ecosystem. Bring farming to the city and bring consumers to the countryside would be open and experiential and build trust. Reclaim the quality terms associated with meat. You can't milk an almond, so you shouldn't be able to meet a mealworm. Second, we must challenge the shameless use of guilt used to induce ethical buying. The organic movement relies on the ancient theme of overcoming the monster to motivate us to avoid scary chemicals in our food, inspiring the free-from trend. The vegan movement relies on the universal theme of tragedy to motivate us to buy an ethical, meat-free and guilt-free diet. Social media is hijacked and corrupted in order to bombard people with messages of guilt and tragedy to keep motivating them to adopt the ideology, and it makes people feel miserable. I believe we have a collective responsibility to self-moderate. Making people feel constantly guilty about their food choices, I think, contributes to every increase in mental health problems. That includes Buy British. Why? It's got to add something. Instead, we must inspire a farming romance. Don't be ashamed of death. Use the power of social media to bring the joy of life. I created a hashtag, February, to provide a channel and focus for these messages. We can all engage in spreading ideas, images and videos showing the love and compassion and fundamental respect we have for our farmed animals. No one says they care more about animals than your average vegan, but we have a lot in common. Finally, farmers are the ultimate guardians and gatekeepers of our animals, so let's stand up for their rights. If UK consumers demand the highest standards of animal welfare, let's champion their cause and make it happen. Be the hero. We can sell fantastic, high quality and flavoursome produce to the world, ride the tides of change and lead the charge on disruptive, innovative thinking. Ladies and gentlemen, there is neither right nor wrong in this debate. Veganism exists only as a balance to the ungrateful commoditisation of animal protein, and I would rather eat a vegetarian meal than a poorly produced meat any day. We have achieved massive success as a species through consuming a varied diet. Who do not forget this debate is a privilege of the fed. No doubt we will be consuming less of it and better quality meat in the future, but I believe we will still be consuming meat. Why? Well, I have with me here a candle. Invented millennia ago from a combination of leaf and wax from bees or fat from an animal carcass. It brings warmth, intimacy and light. To a room. Simultaneously inefficient and utterly pointless as a result of the invention of the electric light bulb. 140 years ago. Back then, we may have predicted that no candles would be sold after the year 2000. Yet more are sold now than ever before, and at prices that make one's eyes water. That is because they're symbolic. The candle is symbolic of the hearth, the warmth, the companionship of our ancient homes. So regardless of resource and innovation, bringing meat home to the table will continue to evoke ancient feelings within us humans. Feelings of togetherness, family and success. More success than the family in the cave next door who failed on their hunt and brought back only leaves and berries. Should we share some of our meat with them? Of course we should. Use it wisely, for it was hard to get hold of and the animals deserve our respect. But it will make our neighbours warm, happy and grateful. They may invite us over for barbecue next weekend. Ladies and gentlemen, we have formed unique and special partnerships with our animal companions. On our ancient evolutionary heritage interlaces meat consumption with universal themes of aspiration and romance. Are we going to vote today for a criminal and blinking genetic mass extinction of farmed animals based on a guilt-induced ideology? Of course we're not. But leading this door through the left-hand side, I also hope that you reflect on your own production and consumption of meat and how you can bring the joy of life to the world for years to come. Thank you.
A speech, and now look for a single final closing floor speaker in Proposition of the Witch.
I disagree with quite a lot of what George has said and written over the years, but on his side, I grew up in the West Highlands of Scotland where my father tried to persuade sheep and cattle to get fat on a diet and raw. rock and bog. And he took his hobby very seriously. It was his first job immediately after the war, was working in northern France, and he saw starvation in Europe as a result of war, but he felt that food production was enormously important. But when he retired in 1987, no one took on that land to farm. It made no sense to farm at great altitude in the West Highlands. What's happened to the land since then? Well, some of it has been fenced to keep the other grass at the end, and it is regenerated as Caledonian pine forest. 30 years on, the environment has changed, the hydrology has changed, the water runoff is much slower. I know that's one of George's key things. And the environment is significantly nicer without the livestock there. So I'm sorry, but I'm going to support the motion.
And now that we're finally done, the opposition.
Mr. Smith, election coming up.
I will admit, the arguments we've heard are not without merit. I personally find this quite perplexing. Just on Monday morning, Mrs. Smith told me she was going to do a Virginiary. I've written it down, it's not a word you'd want to mispronounce. Indeed, I declined her offer on the grounds I wasn't quite sure what I was being asked to give up. I'll confess I have a vested interest. Down on St. Joseph Marsh, where I farm, there are now some black-faced youths who, in human terms, aren't exactly having a good night out. But they're there doing a good job. They're creating a carbon sink on a nicely grazed sward. They're creating an iconic landscape that Charles Dickens wrote poetically about on the Essex Marsh. They are creating biodiversity, a home for curlew, ducks, geese, and 50 other species. But look, let's be clear. This debate is about extremes. We are being asked to support an extreme motion. On this side of the house, we are not arguing we should not embrace change. We are not arguing by 2100 we may have to eat less meat. We are not arguing by 2100 we may have to devise more humane ways to keep livestock. We are not arguing we shouldn't be interested in ways of reducing the carbon footprint of keeping stock. We are not arguing that we shouldn't devise ways of creating a more biodiverse landscape. But what we are saying is the idea that in 2100 no one will eat meat and keeping livestock is a moral crime is toxic nonsense, and we should reject this motion. Thank you.
Thank the Honourable Member for his speech, and indeed all of the four speakers who took part in the debate this evening. I now look to two remarks. Gareth
and
James from the opposition side.
Wow, that was really interesting for me. I'm going to be totally honest, I'm not an academic, but as a young man I went to work for our next door farmer, Bob Bath Butcher, his name was Little Robert the Butcher. I was 10 years old and I was taller than him, but he was a hell of a man. And one thing he said to me, that an ounce of common sense is a lot more worth than any Oxford or Cambridge education. And tonight, we've had a lot of common sense. And for me, that's the way forward. We'll never agree on everything, but what we have to remember is let's respect each other's opinions and move forward as a country to educate our next generation to be happy, healthy, and have plenty of food. And that's what our job is as farmers in whatever we do. Diolch yn fawr o galon. Thank you very much. From the bottom of my heart, I never thought I'd get the opportunity to stand here. And I haven't written anything down, as you can understand. So everything has come from the heart.
And I can say that George has accepted my hat, and we can move forward together as a vegan and farmer to make sure that we don't have these silly, stupid arguments, but we have a debate about where we're going to do it. I'm not going to put this candle out. I think this has been a fantastic speech by my sidekick, or Wonder Woman here, Emily. And it has been an experience that I will take with me to my grave. The offer go on. Thank you very much.
Speech, and now look to George Monbiot to conclude the case for the proposition.
Well, thank you everyone. We've had a lot of fun this evening, especially Stuart and his heart jokes, and what he's talking about is the wind of change. But this is also a deeply serious matter. It's only as if the debate is a privilege of the faith, and that's exactly what we're talking about, because we're talking about whether we're able to feed everybody or only some people, and whether the rich diets of some people, rich in meat, exclude other people from eating at all. Already, as I say, we are using twice our land footprint in this country, and that's at other people's expense, because we can only continue our meat-rich diet in Britain by draining land from other, draining food from other places. So what are they going to do if they want to have the same diet as we do? Find another planet? Tough. It's, you know, this is the choice that we impose on others by pursuing our own choices. Now, you know, I respect that people obviously are making a living, and it's tough enough as it is. You know, I want people to stay on the land, but doing other things. Obviously, looking after nature, a nature-based economy. And I hope, like Gareth, you know, we can find some common ground, we can find some ways forward, but we have to take these existential issues as seriously as they demand. It is better to light a candle than to curse the darkness. But it's better to curse the darkness than to burn your sodding house down.
Thank you. That's all their speech, and that there concludes the end of tonight's debate. I'd like to remind you that in order to vote for the proposition, walk out of the door to the right-hand side, mark eyes. To vote for the opposition, walk out of the door to the left-hand side, mark nays. And with that, I'd like to remain Daniel Robinson and your president for this evening. Thank you very much.
Before we head over to the doors, two small points. First of all, as always, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Drink Solicitors and Savills, for sponsoring this event, without which it wouldn't be possible to do it. And Drinks and Savills have put their heads together, and we have two bottles of champagne to give out. First for the most iconic iconoclastic speaker. Did we? Duncan? Yep, great.
It's quite a tough competition. I was tempted to lower by Tom's product of Drinks. Probably not appropriate to give it to him.